Welcome back to those of you who are A students. Came back for the second session. Excellent work. I mentioned yesterday that ethnically, I'm Assyrian. And, you know, in addition to being of a people group that's talked a lot about in the Old Testament, if you just study general world history, you uncover a lot of, let's just say not so unpleasant things about my people. We used to be known for just extreme brutality, you know? And that's not always the greatest thing to have as a part of your history, but the Assyrians were extremely effective in battle. In fact, we used to attack our enemies and not just defeat them, but we would try to chop off their heads and then throw their heads against walls. We were known to gouge out people's eyeballs. We would skin people alive. In fact, many times we would take our enemies' dead bodies, put them on stakes, light them on fire, and use their burning bodies as light for our parties in the evening. But we're a lot nicer now. I haven't hurt anybody today, so I'm on a roll. Be of good cheer. If you have a question, I won't kill you or anything like that. No. Somebody here was mentioning that they're Syrian. Where is? And half Syrian and half, what was the other name?
Norwegian.
So not Assyrian, but Syrian and Norwegian, which is a very interesting combination. I was thinking about the fact that the woman I married, she's mostly German, and it started to concern me because the Assyrians have a history of brutality, but the Germans also have a history of brutality. And so when we decided to have our children, our first kid came out, I was afraid that he was going to turn out to be the Antichrist. You know, it's like a combination of these two nations, but he's a good kid, at least so far. All right, well, again, enough about my problems. Let's talk about the subject of Islam. Now, many of you, I'm sure, are aware that on the morning of September 11th, 2001, 19 Muslim terrorists hijacked 4 airplanes. And they used those airplanes as missiles to attack the United States. So, you know, they serious damage to the Pentagon, they destroyed the World Trade Center, and in the process of that day, they killed 2,975 innocent civilians. Just 29 days after that event, Oprah Winfrey invited on her TV show this woman, Queen Rania. Now, Queen Rania is the queen of a Muslim country, the country of Jordan, and Queen Rania herself proclaims to be a devout Muslim. And so she allegedly can speak on behalf of Islam. And as you can imagine, her job that day was to fix Islam's massive public relations problem. Because up until that day, most Americans hadn't thought too much about Islam. I mean, maybe they'd seen your typical action Hollywood flick, you know, featuring Arnold Schwarzenegger, where he's going after the bad guys, and the bad guys are Arabs, right? But now that they saw what happened on September 11th, they're wondering, well, wait a minute, is that stereotype that Hollywood portrays, is it true? Is that what Muslims want to do? They want to fly airplanes into our buildings? And so one of the questions that Oprah Winfrey was asking Queen Rania on her show, which is being broadcast around the country, of course, and, you know, seen around the world, was this: do Muslims want to violently force their religion on everyone else? And to this question, Queen Rania said no. She says, the fact that Islam is very tolerant means it doesn't impose anything on other people. Now, Oprah Winfrey, being the good feminist that she is, was also concerned about the treatment of women in Islam. And so she's saying, you know, Queen Rania, we've seen a lot of pictures and images and stories about how women are treated in Muslim countries. Doesn't Islam oppress women, you know, because she's looking at Queen Rania, who's dressed very Westernly, like, you know, much like the way you and I would dress. Well, not like me, but like the women in the room, right? But she's dressed very Westernly, right? So doesn't Islam oppress women? And to this question, she said no. She says, Islam views women as full and equal partners to men. So women's rights are guaranteed in Islam. Now, President Bush was the president at the time of the attacks, and he said that Islam's a peaceful religion, Muslims are a peace-loving people. President Obama, just 6 months after he was became president, traveled to Cairo, Egypt, and gave an address as if speaking to the Islamic world, and said the Holy Quran teaches, and now he's paraphrasing a quote from the Quran, that whoever kills an innocent, it is just as if he has killed all mankind. And whoever saves a person, it is just as if he has saved all mankind. And the point that President Obama is trying to make is that the actions of the people on September 11th were inconsistent with what Islam advances and teaches. So therefore, what was going on, the 9/11 terrorists, these are not Muslims, they're just some kind of rogue, violent terrorists who have hijacked Islam. So, you know, this is not uncommon, right? We hear these kinds of statements about Islam, but at the same time, we turn on the news and we hear all kinds of violence done by people who are professing to be Muslims. You know, even in the country where my family is from, in Iraq, we see a very divided country. We see all kinds of terrorist behavior happening. My cousins, who I still connect with on a regular basis, tell me about all the terrorism going on in Baghdad today. And so then we wonder, well, okay, so which is it? Like, what is the true Islam? Is it the version of President Obama and President Bush and Queen Rania? Or is it the version of Al-Qaeda and ISIS and these other kind of terrorist groups? Is it something in between? Like, will the real Islam please stand up? You know, how do we figure out what is the true authentic version of it? Are Muslims the enemy? Are we supposed to fear them or be against them? Well, fortunately, the Bible helps us to answer this question and gives us a principle for moving forward. And sovereignly, God decided that we were going to talk about being an ambassador for Christ. And so, interestingly, the verse I had thought about to share with you regarding our approach to understanding our own attitude towards Muslims and the religion of Islam is the very verse that we talked about yesterday, where Paul says that we are ambassadors for Christ as though God were making his appeal through us. Just a quick question, though. Is anyone here who was not here last night? Anyone here who was not here last night? Okay, just a few. Okay. Which is fine. Thank you for coming. But we talked about this where we see that Paul is talking about the fact that there is the world, there is us, right, and humanity, and that these two parties are enemies of each other. But Paul says that we as Christians have been reconciled to God, we've been made at peace with God, and so now our message is also to proclaim that same message of reconciliation to the rest of the world. And so I made mention of the fact that what this tells us is that if we claim to be a follower of Jesus Christ, then we already are ambassadors for Christ. Okay? This isn't something that is bestowed upon us, this title, after we've been a Christian for 20 or 40 or 50 years. No, the moment we decide to follow Jesus, we become his ambassador and we become his representative. And so our primary job then, if this is our identity, to be an ambassador for Christ, our primary job then is to be involved in the process of reconciliation. That would be our mission. And so interestingly, Paul answers a key question that many Christians ask throughout their lives, and that is, what's God's will for me? What's God's will for my life? And in a nutshell, Paul answers that question in this particular passage. Number one is to recognize that your identity is that you are an ambassador for Jesus and your mission is to proclaim the message of reconciliation to the rest of the world. Now, granted, how that might flesh itself out amongst the body of believers, as large as we have here today, is going to vary from person to person because the Holy Spirit empowers different people with different gifts. I get it. But largely speaking, that is our identity and that is our mission. So the question then becomes, how do we fulfill that role and that mission when it comes to the subject of Islam? And I submit to you that the answer is exactly the way an ambassador would do it. And what do ambassadors, like political ambassadors, what do they typically do? Well, they first learn, and then they engage. They first learn about the people group they're going to go speak to, and then they go and engage those people. And so I submit to you, we should do the same thing. We should take the same approach when it comes to the subject of Islam. We should learn about Islam, which is the name of the religion, and then we should engage Muslims, who are the people who are following that religion. And so I want to address both of these components this morning and begin by talking about how, as ambassadors for Christ, one of the first steps we need to take is just to have a basic overview and understanding of Islam. Because again, think about it. Any ambassador, any political ambassador who's going to go off to a country, before they go to that country, what are they going to do?
Study.
Yeah, they're going to study. They're going to learn about the country, the people, the demographics, the history, their foreign policy concerns. Why? So when they get there, they can draw upon that knowledge to more carefully craft their message. And the same should be true of ambassadors for Jesus Christ. We should learn about Islam, their religion, their behaviors, their beliefs, their teachings. Why? So we too can draw upon that knowledge to more carefully craft our message, which of course is God's message, which of course is the message of reconciliation, which of course is the gospel, right? So there's a lot of ways, of course, to do that effectively, to learn about Islam. What are some possible approaches that we could take? If you wanted to learn about Islam in general, what are some options that we have available to us? Can anybody give me some ideas? How could you potentially learn about Islam? Yes?
Meet somebody from the Islamic community.
Yeah, you could meet someone from the Islamic community. Maybe you have a neighbor, a classmate, a coworker, or a friend, and just sit down with them someday at a coffee shop and say, hey, you know, I'd love to just know a little bit about what you believe. You know, what does it mean to be a Muslim? I'm really fascinated by this. And by the way, not only will you gain a somewhat of an education about Islam, but you'll also build a relationship and a friendship, okay, with that person, which is, of course, friendships are like a bridge by which we can communicate truth, you know, share the gospel, whatever it might be. So this is a very excellent way to do it. What's something else we can do? Yes? Yes, you could read the Quran. Now, we'll talk about the Quran just in a minute, but the Quran is they believe to be the words of Allah, who they believe to be God. And so that will give you a lot of insight into what they believe is their most holy book. Now, the challenge with the Quran, however, is that it's a very difficult book to read. Okay, and I'm not trying to be mean or, you know, put it down or anything like that, but the Quran is not written in any logical or chronological order. So it's very challenging to read. It's not like with the Bible you have, you know, Genesis, which is, you know, basically the beginning, and you go through Revelation, and it kind of follows a general chronology. It's not like that. And so it would be very difficult to read. In fact, many Muslims themselves have to have additional commentary to make sense of lots of the chapters in the Quran. But yeah, absolutely, that would certainly help you to have a basic understanding of what Muslims believe. Good. What else could you do? Yes?
You could come to the Big Sky World Group Forum and buy a book there about Islam.
That's right. You come to this event and buy a book about Islam. Yeah, let me give you $20 for this. yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so you can come to events where people who have studied Islam or who, you know, interacted with Muslims and have, you know, thought about this a lot can kind of convey that information to you. Good. What else? Google. Yeah, you could internet, you know, do a Google search, look at the internet, you know, yeah. What else?
Listen to the Islamic teachers, sheikhs.
Yeah.
Listen to them on YouTube channels.
Yeah, so you can listen to sheikhs or imams who are like, you know, kind of like pastors or scholars of Islam and see what they say, okay? Now, here's the challenge, though, with a lot of these approaches of studying Islam. You can listen to an imam, a sheikh, or a head of a mosque. You can have a Muslim friend say something. You can listen to these scholars on TV and whatever. But here's the problem you're going to face. You can hear one imam, head of a mosque, for example, say something about Islam, and then go down the street to another mosque or find another imam, and he'll say something completely different or contradictory than the other imam. And by the way, that's also true of Muslim friends. I've had many Muslim friends over the years who I've talked to, and some will say one thing, and the other will say, no, that's not true, it's completely, you know, false. And so then you're left with the same predicament that I was mentioning at the beginning. How do you know which is the real version of Islam? Because people make all kinds of claims. And it becomes very confusing to know what to believe. So I have a tactic that I use that is expressed by this principle, and that is this. If you want to know what is truly authentic version of Islam, what you have to be concerned about is authoritative sources in Islam. Because what matters in Islam is authority. And what you'll discover as we talk here and as you perhaps experience Muslims or engage with the Islamic community in the future, What you'll discover is there is a difference between what authoritative Islamic teaching says and what many Muslims claim. There's a difference between what Islamic authoritative sources say and what many Muslims will oftentimes claim. And so this is a key thing. You need to look at what does the authoritative sources say. That's what true and authentic Islam is. All right, this is a very important distinction. So what are some of the key authoritative sources that we need to know about in order to have that understanding of, okay, this is essential Islam? Well, here's the first one, and this is already mentioned by the young lady over there, the Quran. Okay? The Quran is believed by Muslims to be the literal words of Allah. Now notice I said literal words of Allah. They don't believe that the Quran is the inspired word of God, which is what we believe about the Bible. Now this is an important distinction, because with Christianity we say that the doctrine of inspiration is that the Holy Spirit, who is God, inspired human authors using their language and style and grammar to write down certain things, and what they ended up writing down was exactly what God wanted them to write down. Okay, this is the doctrine of inspiration. That's not what Muslims believe about the Quran. They believe that the Quran is a book that has existed in heaven with Allah, and that the contents of the Quran were dictated word for word by the angel Gabriel to a man named Muhammad from 610 to 632 AD. So the angel Gabriel appears to a man named Muhammad and literally starts to say, hey, recite these words. And Muhammad, over a 22-year period, memorized those words as the angel returned to him multiple times and told him the contents of this information. He memorized it, and then he passed it on to other people. And that is what is now the contents of the Quran. It is believed to be the highest authority in Islam. In fact, I was just talking to somebody here about how Muslims often will never put the Quran on the floor, or if they put it on a shelf, it's always on the highest shelf, and they express a lot of reverence towards it. And part of the reason is that if you ask a Muslim, well, what's the corollary of the Quran in Christianity? Now, you might think it's the Bible, but the Muslims say, no, the corollary to the Quran in Christianity would be Christ himself. Just like we would say that Christ is the divine logos, the divine word, they would believe that the Quran is the divine word of Allah. So the Quran is the highest authority, okay, in Islam. But there's another source of authority that is important for our purposes, and that is called hadith, or hadith literature. Now, these are written traditions that might be a sentence long, a paragraph long, or even longer. They're written traditions of what Muhammad either said or approved of. Now, so for example, if one day in the 7th century, hot Saudi Arabian sun, Muhammad's walking around and someone comes to him and says, Muhammad, some men over here are praying, but they're really being distracted by these dogs over here that are barking. What should we do about this? So Muhammad would say, well, okay, whenever men are praying, we need to make sure that we keep dogs away from the prayer, keep away at least 50 yards. Not that they use yards as a measurement metric or something like that, but you get what I mean, right? So they said, oh, okay, no dogs for 50 yards when men are praying. And so they would write it down, and eventually they would have that put into these large volumes. Okay? Now, Muhammad spoke about a whole bunch of matters, like marriage, divorce, fasting, fighting, prayer, pilgrimages, all kinds of things. And all the things that he spoke about, people remembered, wrote down, and put in these large, large volumes. And they're now called hadith, or hadith literature. Again, written traditions of what Muhammad said or approved of. Now, it's important to understand that this is not on the same level as the Quran. It is below the level of the Quran in terms of authority, because it's not the divine word of Allah. Okay? Nevertheless, hadith literature is still extremely important, because it gives very practical application to the broad principles that are in the Quran. So, for example, the Quran might command you to fight, but the hadith will tell you how to fight, who to fight, when to start, when to stop. The Quran might command you to pray, but the hadith will tell you how to pray, when to pray, what to do before prayer, what to do after prayer, all the details of that. How many here have heard of the term Sharia law? Raise your hand if you've heard of the Sharia law. Oh, it's just about everybody then. So Sharia law is simply Islamic law that is instituted in various Muslim countries. Civil laws and criminal laws. Okay. Where do they get their ideas for these laws? Right here. Hadith literature. Because Hadith literature is extremely practical, has a lot of practical application for everyday Muslim living. So that is a second source, key source of authority in Islam. And the third source of authority that I want you to be aware of is called the Sunnah. And this is the life example of Muhammad. He is believed to be the perfect embodiment of what it means to be a Muslim. And so, you know, if Muhammad did something and it was eventually, you know, written down or remembered, people say, okay, well, then we should behave in the same way. You remember many years ago, it was really popular amongst Christians to wear a wristband with the letters WWJD. What would Jesus do? Because we think, oh, you know, Jesus is kind of a guide for us for how we should live as well. Well, if Muslims had that same sort of marketing thing, it would be WWMD. You know, what would Muhammad do? I mean, they don't have that, but that's basically what they're thinking. How Muhammad lived in his day is authoritative for Muslims today. And so I want you to notice then, we have three sources, three important sources of authority. The Quran, the Hadith, and the Sunnah. And this provides us with a very handy tactic for determining whether a teaching or a behavior is truly Islamic. If you want to know, is it Islamic? Just simply ask, is it found in the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sunnah? If so, then we can say, yes, it's Islamic. If it's not found in these three sources, or it's rejected by these three sources, then it's not Islamic. I don't care if a queen of a Muslim country says that Islam is about needlepoint and flying kites. It's not going to make it true. Doesn't matter who she is. Doesn't matter if it's the president of any country. If it violates the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sunnah, it is not Islamic. So let's apply this tactic to perhaps the most common question I'm asked about Islam. And that is this. Violent jihad. Is violent jihad a valid Islamic doctrine? Now, listen carefully to the question I'm asking. I'm not asking, are most Muslims violent? I'm not asking, are most Muslims engaged in jihad? I'm not asking, should you not befriend a Muslim? These are all different questions. I'm simply asking a very, granted, academic question, although it has practical implications. But I'm just saying, is violent jihad a valid doctrine in Islam, a valid teaching? And notice also I'm saying violent jihad because many Muslims you talk to will say, oh, jihad, it's got such a bad name, you know. Jihad just means struggle, you know. And the Quran talks about the struggle, the jihad that we have of the tongue, for example, the jihad of the tongue, which is a struggle to make sure that what we say with our mouth is good, true, and noble. Or we have a jihad of the heart, which is a struggle to make sure that we have good intentions. Which I'm not denying, that's true. That is what jihad means, just means struggle. But I'm going to argue there's no doubt also that the concept of violent jihad, to fighting for the cause of Allah, is a valid doctrine in Islam. And again, how do we determine if that's true or not? Well, we can ask Queen Rania. We can ask our Muslim neighbor. We can go to the mosque and ask the imam there. And they might give us an answer. And so long as that answer is consistent with what three sources? The Quran, the Hadith, and the Sunnah, then okay, fine. But remember, I've talked to Muslims in the United States and in the Middle East for years, and I get all kinds of answers. So what do? I use the tactic. All right, is it taught in the Quran? Well, the answer is yes. Violent jihad is taught in the Quran. In fact, there's 164 verses that teach about violent jihad in the Quran. If you were to want to read some of them, okay, the Quran is divided up into chapters. These chapters, chapters are called surahs in the Quran. So Surah 8 and 9, or chapters 8 and 9, would be two chapters that have a high content of discussion about violent jihad and how to engage in it. You see in chapter 2, it says that fighting is prescribed for the Muslim, even if you dislike it. Chapter 9, we see it says, fight those who do not believe in Allah or don't believe in the last day. It says, fight them even if they are people of the book, which is a reference to Christians and Jews. So there's lots of statements about that. And this shouldn't be surprising because the Quran was revealed to a man named Muhammad who during his 22 years where he was proclaiming Islam, he was routinely involved in warfare, commonly. So it's not surprising that the Quran would give him directives as to how to prosecute wars. Okay. But it's not just taught in the Quran, it's also taught in the Hadith. Remember, I said the Hadith is categorized by subject, right? There's discussions about fasting and prayer and pilgrimages and so on and so forth. Well, there's a whole section of Hadith literature called the Book of Jihad, where it has all of the statements of Muhammad or the approvals of Muhammad that have been collated and put together and stuck in this one section called the Book of Jihad. And here, in that section of Hadith literature, we see the details about how to fight, when to fight, who to fight. You have, here you see also where it says that apostasy is a capital crime, meaning if you abandon your faith in Islam, you can be killed for it. You see here in the Hadith literature that this is where also it says that homosexual sex is a capital crime, you can be killed for that as well. So all the details of how to engage in violent jihad are found in the Hadith as well. So the Quran, the Hadith both teach violent jihad clearly. And then it's also taught the Sunnah. Remember, the Sunnah is the life example, the biography, if you will, of Muhammad. And the earliest extant biography that we have is called The Life of Muhammad by Ibn Ishaq. You can buy this book on Amazon. It's like this thick. I had to read it in school. It's long, and it's rated R, okay? But it's the earliest extant biography we have of Muhammad, written by Muslims to explain to the world who Muhammad is, okay? Well, if you read it, you will see that Muhammad, as I said, was routinely involved in warfare. Right? He led numerous attacks on caravans, because he was in the caravan trading business as his initial career. So he knew their routes. He would attack these caravans to gain money. He led major military campaigns. He ordered the assassinations of non-combatants. There was a Jewish man who used to write poetry against the Muslims. He ordered him to be assassinated. These two girls used to sing satirical songs against Muhammad. He ordered them to be assassinated. And perhaps in one of the most grievous examples of jihad, after the Muslims had conquered a city called Medina, he ordered the execution of all of the Jews that remained in that city. And he took out the men, laid them out in the middle of the street there, of the town square. And his biography says that he had them all beheaded. And the biography boasts, it says, there were 600 or 700 men in all, though some put the figure as high as 800. Now, again, this is the Sunnah of Muhammad, authoritative. The Hadith, authoritative. The Quran, the highest authority. All teach that violent jihad is a valid doctrine. Now, you might be thinking, I mean, maybe you're not, but sometimes people are like, oh, come on now, this can't be the case. That just sounds so over the top. It just sounds like you're one of those, you know, exaggerating Christians who are just, you know, making it seem worse than it is. And I wish I was, but it's not. Could you be wrong, though, Alan, about this? I suppose. But here's another way we can kind of evaluate if this is really what Muhammad taught and what Islam taught at its beginning. Let's just look at the people who knew Muhammad the best. His friends, his family, and his successors. These are called caliphs. How did the successors of Muhammad, after he died, how did they move forward with the, you know, beginnings of the Islamic community? We can look at this, because now this becomes simply a matter of history when you see how the successors to Muhammad took off with what Muhammad said. So here's a map of, you got Europe and North Africa here, and Middle East here. Now, this dark orange portion of Saudi Arabia, here's Mecca and Medina, which is the two cities that Muhammad mostly lived and died, spent his time. The dark orange portion here is the portion of Saudi Arabia that was conquered by Islam at the time of Muhammad's death, which was 632 AD. Okay. Now, he dies in 632 AD. I want you to remember one other date, which is exactly 100 years later, which would be what date? 732, okay. So in just 100 years, which is a small amount of time to see what the Muslim armies did, but take a look at what happened, okay? These arrows show the direction of Islamic military forces, right? So he dies in 632 AD. Soon afterwards, they come and they conquer all of Saudi Arabia. Muslim armies advance, they conquer Jerusalem and conquer Israel and all of the Middle East. Then Islamic armies advance eastward, all the way conquering the lands, all the way to the borders of India and China. Then the Islamic armies advance into North Africa. They conquer all of North Africa. By the way, why do they not conquer this area below?
It's all desert.
Just desert, you know, sand. What do you do with that, right? Make circuit boards, right? Okay, whatever. So Muslim armies, of course, cross the Strait of Gibraltar. They advance, they conquer Spain. And then you see the Muslim armies advancing into France, and then they make a U-turn. Okay, it's not because they passed a Chick-fil-A and they're like, oh, we gotta go back for that amazing Chick-fil-A sauce, man, it's awesome. No, they made a U-turn because they were stopped by, do you know who? Charles the Hammer, Charles Martel, whose own forces, military forces, stopped the Muslim invasion. Okay, these were military forces that they had to fight back. This was not some peaceful, you know, assembly. Mostly peaceful, right, as they say. It was not the case. Now, when Muslim military forces conquered these lands, they gave the conquered people what's called the triple choice in Islam. And the triple choice is this. Okay, they said, look, you are now under Islamic control, and you have three choices. Number one is you can now convert to Islam if you so choose. And if you do choose to convert to Islam, you'll be a full member of our community with all the rights and privileges of another Muslim. But many people did not want to convert to Islam. Fine. Muslims said, you don't have to convert, but if you're going to continue to live in our lands, you have to pay what's called a jizya, which is a poll tax that will allow you to live in our land. We will provide you with protection, but you will be a second-class citizen. Now, some people didn't want to convert, didn't want to pay the poll tax, and so your third option is, well, then you have to fight us. And if you win, you get your land back. If you lose, you die. By the way, when ISIS conquered parts of northern Iraq, where many of my people, the Assyrians, live, they did the same exact thing. They offered the triple choice. They said, okay, convert to Islam, which, of course, many Assyrians did not want to do because we're historically Christian, or pay a poll tax. But the poll tax that ISIS levied on the people in these small villages was so high no one could afford it. The third option to fight ISIS was not an option because nobody had the capacity to fight ISIS. So what happened? Everybody fled. Remember the huge immigration and stuff? Like, people were flooding out of northern Iraq into Jordan, into Lebanon. I routinely go to Beirut and Lebanon to speak and teach there. I met my cousin's son who fled Iraq and came into Lebanon, and that's where I saw him, and he was safe there for a time. It's crazy. But they did the same exact thing. Now, I hear two kinds of responses when people hear about this particular data about what happened in early Islam. First response people say is, look, Alan, look, I'm a Muslim. I'm not violent. My family's not violent. My friends aren't violent. I don't know any Muslims that are violent. That's just not me. I don't practice violence. And when they tell me this, my Muslim friends, I say, you know what? I believe you. I agree. I don't doubt what you're saying. And I'm glad you're not a violent person. But notice, this is in spite of what the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sunnah teach, not because of what it teaches. Now, please do not misunderstand what I'm saying. Keep in mind, I'm still just talking about the technical question, is violent jihad a valid doctrine? I'm not trying to argue that Muslims are dangerous, wicked people that you should have no part in a relationship with them. In fact, I think that's actually very false. And not only did my family grow up in the Middle East, but even after we were living in the United States, my father routinely would travel to the Middle East to do work. Muslims would come back to the States. They'd come and stay with us. Every time they'd enter our house, they'd be super respectful, very mindful of our traditions. They'd always bring us a gift. I teach in the Middle East, in the West Bank, in Egypt, in Lebanon, every single year. And every time I go to a Muslim's house, they welcome me. They cook this massive, amazing feast. And by the way, the kebabs are to die for, okay? Just, man, throw a little pita bread, some hummus. Oh, just amazing, okay? You don't want to pass this up, okay? The point I'm making is, look, generally speaking, most Muslims are incredibly kind people. In fact, because they live in an honor-shame culture, they tend to be very concerned about whether they're going to come across as shameful or come across as honorable. So please do not hear me say that I'm trying to argue that most Muslims are dangerous, evil people that you should avoid. That's not the case, right? Again, I'm just answering the question, is violent jihad a valid doctrine within the religion of Islam? Now, the other response I hear quite often from imams and sheikhs and whatever, scholars, will say, well, look, Islam's a peaceful religion. It's just been hijacked, like ISIS people or September 11th, it's just been hijacked by violent terrorists. And to this statement, I disagree. In fact, I think the opposite's true. Seems to me that Islam has been a violent religion that thankfully has been hijacked by peaceful Muslims. Right? Because look, at its core, the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sunnah, and early Islam was incredibly violent. Thankfully, though, most Muslims don't want to live like this. You know, in Lebanon, I don't know if any of you have been to Lebanon, it's quite an interesting country because despite it being predominantly Muslim, it's very secular, right? You can walk around in malls in Beirut, and it feels like you're in an American mall. And most of the women there don't dress, you know, covering their hair, you know, which is called the hijab. They don't cover themselves head to toe. They walk around, some girls wearing spaghetti strap, you know, tops, you know, and revealing lots of their skin. I'm like, wow, this is very bizarre. You go to Egypt, very different picture. Egypt is incredibly devout and religious, and the vast majority of women are covered completely. Oh, not completely, but they're covering their hair, and many of them are covered completely. But even in Egypt, where you see far more devoutness towards the religious faith, when their past president was taken out of power and they got in a new guy, and he was part of the Muslim Brotherhood, they were like, oh man, we don't want this guy in power. And so they led a revolt against him because they didn't want this guy who was this super devout Muslim that's going to bring back Egypt back to the 7th century. Why? Because most Muslims don't want to live like this. They want to have a job. They want to have a peaceful time, right? Now, the most common objection or response I hear to this, people say, well, Alan, but Christianity also has its own jihad. I mean, come on, let's be real. Have you ever read the Old Testament? Like, holy cow. Talk about violent and bloody. Christianity has its own jihad. I mean, you see killings in the Old Testament. We have Christian terrorists today, like Timothy McVeigh. You got a military in the United States military in the Middle East today killing Muslims, and a lot of these military are Christians. You got the Crusades, you got the Spanish Inquisition, and you go on and on and on. You see, even Christianity has its own jihad. Now, I disagree with this assessment. I don't think there is a parallel to jihad in Christianity for three reasons. Okay? First reason is this. War and killing in the Old Testament, yes, there is plenty of it. Nobody's trying to even hide that fact. But war and killing in the Old Testament serve a completely different purpose than what we see with regards to Islam. Because if you recall, God used war and killing not as a means of spreading the religion, but as an instrument of judgment against wicked and evil people. Right? Oftentimes, God would use Israel as an instrument of judgment against, say, like the Canaanites. Okay? Now, the Canaanites were not just, you know, big bullies, right, who cyber-stalk people. Okay? These were seriously wicked people who would melt children on hot altars. And God waited patiently for 400 years. And these people failed to repent. God said, finally, enough is enough. And then he used Israel as an instrument of judgment against the wicked Canaanites to destroy them. Now, here's what's rather interesting. God certainly used Israel as an instrument of judgment against other wicked people, but he was just as willing to use other people groups, like the Assyrians, my people, woohoo, as an instrument of judgment against Israel when Israel committed sin. Notice, God judges sin regardless of who commits it. God's an equal opportunity judger, for better or for worse. Right? Now, this is not the case with Islam and Muhammad, who used war and killing simply as a means of expanding the Islamic empire and defeating the enemies. And Muhammad used war and violence to achieve his goals, and the next four successors after Muhammad, for 400 years, used jihad as a means of expanding the Islamic empire. By contrast, Christianity for the first 300 years had no army. And despite intense persecution and the slaughter of Christians, Christianity still spread like wildfire. Second of all, war and killing that we find described in the Old Testament is descriptive, not prescriptive. Meaning, God's commands in the Old Testament, where he says, okay, go and take out these people, were localized and specific only to that instance, and it's not intended to be made normative for Christians today. So in other words, war and killing describes what happened, not what should happen. In fact, I don't know of any theology, I don't know of any church or any seminary or any organized Christian group that believes that the Old Testament commands to kill are somehow normative for Christians today. Now, were the Crusades based on some kind of Bible theology? Yes, they were. But guess what? It was mistaken theology. And the church has since repudiated that theology because they realized it's inconsistent with biblical teaching. But by contrast, Islam still has a robust school of theology devoted to teaching of jihad. And no Muslim scholar, at least not in the Middle East, you might find them in the States who are trying to be PC, but in the Middle East, there's no Muslim scholar that would deny jihad as a valid doctrine and theological tradition in Islam. And so that's why when Muslims engage in violence, many times but not always, they are doing something that is consistent with their theology, whereas when Christians have engaged in violence, as we've seen in some of these examples, they are behaving inconsistent with their theology. And the third reason I'd say why there is no parallel to jihadi Christianity is that Jesus is the paradigm for us as Christians. Right? I mean, this guy, Jesus, was so peaceful that many people mistake him for being a pacifist. I'm not saying he was, but people think so. Some do, at least. But he had multiple assassination attempts made upon his life, and Jesus never once responded with violence. And when Peter draws a sword to defend Jesus, Jesus says, Peter, put away your sword. Those who live by the sword die by the sword. And in his final command before he ascends into heaven, Jesus gives what's called the great what? Commission, which is to make disciples of all nations. Notice, that is a persuasive enterprise. It is not a military enterprise. Muhammad, on his deathbed, however, said he was ordered, not only did he order the assassination of non-combatants, but on his deathbed, he said he was ordered to fight all the people until everyone says, there is no God but Allah. That's what he's claimed in the authoritative sources again. So if Muslims want to insist that they follow a religion of peace, my suggestion to them has always been that you should follow Jesus. Because he's called the Prince of Peace. Okay, so again, remember what the reason is for bringing this up. It's just as an example to see how we can apply the tactic of looking at authoritative sources to determine whether a teaching or a behavior is actually valid or not. We can do the same thing with, for example, a teaching on, women in Islam. Is Queen Rania correct about what Islam says about women? Well, it doesn't matter what she says. What matters is what does the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sunnah teach? And that's what we're going to look at. We're not going to do that right now, but I'm just saying that's the way you'd approach that particular question. Now, what else can we learn about Islam? Well, in Islam, they are also required to have certain behaviors that they must engage in and certain beliefs or doctrines that they must adhere to. Now, the required behaviors are called the five pillars of Islam. Maybe you've heard that phrase. The five pillars of Islam are required behaviors. Here's the first one. Every Muslim must recite the creed. And the creed is simple. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet, or Muhammad is his messenger. Okay? This is a confessional statement that declares their allegiance to Allah and, of course, to Islam. And in fact, if you wanted to become a Muslim here this morning, all you got to do is say this creed, and of course, sincerely believe it, right? And you will have started your journey as a Muslim. Okay, that's how you begin. In fact, many times I take Christians, both high school students as well as adults, we go to mosques. We spend a couple of days training about understanding Islam and how to reach out winsomely, persuasively, and graciously to Muslims, and then we go to the mosque. You know, because many people are like, what happens behind the doors of a mosque? It's a mystery. Okay, let's blow that mystery up, okay? I mean, figuratively, like, let's go in and see. I didn't mean to say that, but I think this is not recorded. What I meant is, I want to get rid of this idea like, oh, there's some secret thing going on behind the doors of a mosque. No, we go in and we see, we observe their services, we get a tour of the mosque, we engage with the Muslims, we have Q&A time with the imam there or the other scholars there. Okay, and many times when we've done that, during the service that they have, they'll oftentimes bring up some kids from their Islamic community who will come up to the front and they'll say this creed because they're declaring their allegiance now to Islam. They're becoming Muslims. So that's the first required behavior. A second required behavior in Islam is daily prayer. Muslims are required to pray five times a day. So at sunrise, at noon, at mid-afternoon, at sunset, and then just before they go to bed. Now, does anyone know what direction Muslims face when they pray? Besides you. He's like, duh. He grew up as a Muslim, so that's why he kind of answered some questions. What you said, east, is that what I heard?
Okay. Towards Mecca.
Yeah, towards Mecca. So it may be east, depending on where Mecca, which is in Saudi Arabia, is. Okay. I'm thinking here in Montana. My guess, even though Mecca is southeast of Montana on a map, my guess is that the direction of prayer in Montana would be northeast. Now, does anyone know why that would be the case? That's all I heard. I'm sure the answer was there, which is yes. The earth is a globe. It's on a map, right? So the direction of prayer is the direction a bird would fly to make the most direct route to Mecca, and so that would be over towards the North Pole and down like this way. So, yeah, my guess if we went to a mosque here in Billings would be that, is there a mosque in Billings? Does anyone know? There is? Yeah. So my guess is that they would have a wall which indicates what's called the Qibla, the direction of prayer, and it would be facing towards northeast. That would be my guess, but I'm not sure. It's interesting, when I fly to the Middle East, you know, there's a screen oftentimes in the seat in front of you. And there are sometimes there's apps there that will tell you which is the direction of the Qibla, which is the direction of prayer. Because you're on like a 15-hour flight, and certainly a few times of prayer are going to happen during that flight. So if you're a Muslim, you can kind of look and be, oh, it's that way, you know. And so they face that direction to pray. But that's very significant for them. They pray five times a day. Now, why are they facing towards Mecca? Why do they pray towards Mecca? What's so significant about Mecca?
City.
What's that?
Their city.
It is their holiest city. Why is it their holiest city? What's there? What's that? Well, yeah, Muhammad was certainly born there, but that's not the reason why they're its holiest city. Does anybody know?
The Kaaba.
Yes, the Kaaba. So in the city of Mecca, there is a 30-foot by 30-foot cube structure, which actually the title slide of this PowerPoint had that big structure. That's the Kaaba. It's about 30 feet by 30 feet, cube structure, masonry structure. And Muslims believe that Allah sent a meteorite to Earth, and it impacted in that location, and that's where either Adam and Eve or Abraham, different traditions say different things, was ordered to construct that Kaaba, and that should be the direction everybody should face when they pray. Okay. So we'll also, you'll see a picture of it in just a minute, but what's interesting is During Muhammad's time, that particular city of Mecca was conquered by a lot of pagan tribes. When Muhammad gained 10,000 soldiers when he was living a few hundred miles north, he came back to Mecca to conquer Mecca. And when he came back, the first thing he did was he went into the Kaaba and he got rid of all the idols that were in there that people used to worship toward, the false idols, you know, because Muhammad was preaching monotheism. And so, yeah, the Kaaba is the direction of prayer. If you ever happen to be inside the Kaaba, which nobody here ever will be, because, by the way, if you're not a Muslim, you can't even enter into the city of Mecca, barring a few exceptions for, like, contractors and some heads of state, whatever, stuff like that. But generally speaking, no Christians even allowed in the city of Mecca. But if you happen to be in the city of Mecca, and if you happen to be at the Kaaba, and just happen to be inside the Kaaba, which, again, I'm sure none of us have this problem, you technically can pray in any direction. So, huge fringe benefit, right, if you're inside. You're not limited to one direction. So, daily prayer is a required behavior in Islam. A third required behavior is the fast of Ramadan. Okay, this is a one-month-long fast where during the daylight hours of each day, Muslims must abstain from eating, drinking, smoking, and sex. Now, before sunrise and after sunset, they can engage in those activities. But during the daylight hours, they have to fast from it. And the purpose of this fast is to commemorate Muhammad receiving the Quran from which angel?
Gabriel.
Gabriel, that's right. Very good. A fourth required behavior in Islam is the giving of alms. Muslims are supposed to give about 2.5% of their income that goes to serve the poor and the needy. So if you happen to be a Christian and believe in tithing, 10%, notice it's more cost-effective to be a Muslim. You know, I'm not saying that should be incentive for you to convert, but just FYI. And then the fifth required behavior in Islam is the pilgrimage to Mecca. And this is required at least once in the lifetime of a Muslim to travel to Saudi Arabia, to Mecca, and for a period of a week or so, perform a number of different rituals. And you can see here, this is the most holy mosque in Islam. In this kind of center of it, there is the structure, which is the Kaaba that we're making reference to. It's not actually black. That's like a tarp that's laid over it. Not a tarp, it's fabric. And the gold trim there actually has the Quranic verses around it. And remember I mentioned there was a meteorite that came down? Allegedly, they'd taken that meteorite and stuck it into the corner, one of the corners of the Kaaba. And so as Muslims go around in circles, they'll used to try to touch it or kiss that rock, but now they just kind of point to it. And that's just part of the ritual that they perform when they're there during this Hajj. Fortunately, Muslims are although they're required to do this at least once in their lifetime, exceptions are made for people who financially can't afford to go there or maybe physically incapable due to, you know, some sort of medical issue. But that's a downside, because in Islam, as we'll learn after the break, that behaviors, deeds, are what gives you merit in Islam. They have a meritorious based system of salvation. So although you might be exempt from doing such a thing, you're going to miss out on the meritorious benefits of performing this particular Hajj. Okay, we're going to take a break in just a few minutes. Are there any questions about what we've covered so far? Comments, clarifications before we take a break and then jump to the next material afterwards. Yes?
I have a question. What is Christianity or taught that the Bible has the most amount of manuscripts to substantiate the validity of the book? Do they have that same substantiation for the Quran that have been in the Quran? And also in the Muslim world, if they don't subscribe to those teachings and they are a peaceful Muslim, why don't we see Muslims rising up against this violent act if we don't see it?
Yeah, okay, good question. So let me take the second question first, which is if there's many Muslims who are not willing to subscribe to the violence that's promoted by a lot of other Muslims, why don't we see more Muslims rising up and condemning that? Well, first of all, there are Muslims that do rise up and condemn it, but it's probably a small minority of the 1.5 billion Muslims that are on the earth. And second of all, I'm not sure what they're going to condemn. The problem isn't that there's people engaging in violence. The problem is that the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sunnah teach it. So unless you're going to do something about the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sunnah, which are authoritative sources that aren't changing anytime soon, there's little value in saying, okay, stop doing what the Quran did or teaches. Stop doing what Muhammad practiced. I mean, it would be a useless kind of claim, right? So that's the reason why there's not going to be a lot of Muslims who are going to come up and say, hey, stop doing this. I mean, stop doing what? Stop following the Quran? It'd be like someone telling us, you know, hey, stop loving your enemies to a Christian. Well, I'm supposed to. Stop praying to Jesus. Well, we're commanded to, you know. Stop maintaining a biblical sexual ethic. Well, but that's what Jesus calls us to do in Matthew 19. So it's like there's little potential of making any difference doing that. So that's why I would say there isn't that much of a condemnation of that kind of behavior, although it does happen. Your first question about are there manuscripts like we have with the Bible of the Quran, and to what degree are they available? This is a whole very, very fascinating field of study because it's rather new. Up until the last, like, 30 or 40 years, you weren't really allowed to ask that question. You know, for Muslim scholars to say, well, what's the manuscript tradition that we have in the Quran? You know, is there any variance? Because the Quranic or the Muslim claim is actually a greater claim than what Christians make. We Christians would say the Bible is inerrant in its autographs, meaning the original documents that Paul wrote, you know, that John wrote, when they wrote those documents are inerrant without any mistakes. But Christian textual critics would acknowledge that for thousands of years, yes, there's been some variations in the manuscripts, although we can figure out what they are, and we can figure out what the original said with virtually 100% accuracy. And so that's the field of textual criticism. But for the Muslim, their claim is that the Quran, which exists in heaven, was given to Muhammad verbally, memorized perfectly, eventually written down perfectly, and has been copied perfectly. And so the Quran they have today is an exact duplicate of the Quran that exists in heaven. Now that is a much bolder claim. And the problem with that claim is that it's just not true, because in the last... Well, in 1973, some people were doing some repair work in a mosque in Yemen, in Sana'a. And when they were doing some repairs in the walls, they discovered some scrolls. It turned out these scrolls were manuscripts from the 8th century of the Quran. And, 7th century of the Quran. And when they looked at that, they're like, wow, how do we interpret this? Like, you know, this is, you need an expert. They hired a German Orientalist named Gerhard Puhin, who is an expert in studying ancient Arabic script. But the condition was that he is not allowed to report any of his findings to anyone except for the Yemeni's government. Now, let's just say we know Gerhard Puhin. And so we know that there has been some revelations about what he discovered. And also since then, additional scholars have now taken on work not funded by the Yemeni's government to investigate this. Now, these manuscripts are fascinating because they are called palimpsests, which means if you just read them, it looks like there's just one set of Quranic script on there. But if you, I forget if it's through an x-ray or something else, you look through the manuscript, what you notice is there was an original text there below that was washed away, and then a new script was put on top. Now, you can't see it with the naked eye, but you can see it with appropriate equipment. What we see there is a change in original manuscripts of the Quran that have later changed in more recent editions. And so we see variations, huge variations. So this is a very fascinating and exciting, at least for non-Muslims, but for Muslims, it's a very, very bad news because their narrative about how the Quran originated and has been passed down is not true. There are massive amounts of changes that were made in addition to missing surahs, and actually some of the hadith literature, which again is Islamic writings, about what Muhammad said or Buddha, he even acknowledges that there were verses and chapters that are missing that we don't know where they are, and they're not found in the Quran today. So the narrative is not consistent with the evidence. But more of that will come out in the next 5 or 10 years as more scholars now are taking up that particular study.
Alan, why don't we take a break?
Yes.
A comment from me. You're the fourth person that spoke for us on Islam. Every one of them has covered different issues. I want to salute you for gracefully handling the question of, is it peaceful? And that kind of, you've done very, very well. Thank you for that clarity. However, to quote the book of Revelations, he's from California, you have to kind of keep nudging him. Kind of like being from Powell. I have something against you.
Oh, yes. Well, I was going to get to that in the next section because there's a national place.
We're going to take a break and sell books.
Oh, yes, of course. So if you are interested in kind of what I'm kind of the approach I'm taking with Islam, I wrote a short book called The Ambassador's Guide to Islam. Notice it's called The Ambassador's Guide because we're, Standard Reason, who I work for, we're heavily influenced by this idea that this is a very significant aspect of our identity, that we're an ambassador for Christ, and how we interact is significant. So I've written this guide as an ambassadorial approach to how we would engage Islam. How do we understand Islam in a basic sense? It's only 64 pages, so you could like knock this sucker out in an afternoon, right? I think did you read the whole thing?
Yeah.
Just from yesterday to today? Yeah, that's amazing. You know? And his shirt's even green that matches this. So, so consider getting that out. And of course, remember, yesterday we talked about how I wasn't able to cover the art of conversational persuasion, but tactics is way more foundational than even the book I wrote, but my boss wrote this one, and it's excellent, and it applies to everything, especially your conversations with Muslims. It would be very applicable. So,